Attached to the wall of the arklet, with strips of blue masking tape, was a sheet of paper on which had been printed the seal of the President of the United States. Only two printers remained in existence, and both of them were on Izzy. So by process of elimination, this must have been printed on old Earth, prior to the hard rain, by a device that had been running a little low on cyan ink. It had seen hard service. It was torn in two places and repaired with clear tape. It had been creased and crumpled, then smoothed out. Its edges were fuzzy where previous applications of tape had been peeled away. And in the white space below and to the right of the presidential seal, there was a brown smudge, oval, the size of the ball of a person's thumb. As a matter of fact, Tekla was certain that it was actually a thumbprint, and the more she looked at it, the more certain she became that the brown substance was blood. She looked Julia in the eye and became aware that the former president was awaiting some form of reaction from her. Unlike most people, Tekla felt no pressure, no obligation to fulfill any such expectations. Julia, a bit unnerved by that, broke eye contact and continued, "I don't quite understand the story they are telling us, anyway."
"It is pretty convoluted,"
said one of her aides, a young male Arky with an American accent. He was one of the MIV engineers. His tone suggested that he was amused by the sheer cheekiness of the powers that be in trying to get people to believe such a yarn, and that he was much too clever to be taken in.
"It kind of hinges on the idea that the hull was made of what amounts to plastic. If it gets too hot, it..."
"It's like plastic on a stove burner, I understand that," Julia said. "It melts and it stinks."
"Nucaird shifted in a way that caused the hull to come into contact with a nozzle that was extremely hot."
"But according to the story they are putting out, Vyacheslav had shut that nozzle off beforehand."
"They stay hot for a long time. Anyway, the nozzle melted right through the hull. First, it would have made a lot of toxic smoke. That would have been enough to kill him. Then, when the melting proceeded to the point where the hull was perforated, all the air would have escaped through the hole."
"Well, that is horrible, if it is true," Julia said, and then swiveled her eyes toward Tekla, looking for some sign in the visitor's face that it might not be true. Tekla stared back at her in a manner that betrayed nothing. "What sort of pass have we come to, one wonders, when such crazy improvisations are called for, ramming one ship with another?" More murmurs of agreement. Julia was on a roll, and as far as I can make out, it didn't even solve the problem.
"Problem is solved," Tekla said.
She was fluent in English and was perfectly capable of saying, "the problem is solved," but sometimes dropped the article for effect. Anglophones found this mysterious and impressive. It was also an implicit statement of Russian pride. The language of the Cloud Ark, by default, was English. That was never going to change. But the dialect was going to evolve over time, and Russians could bend it in their direction by finding ways to inject their grammar and vocabulary into everyday speech.
"Burn is complete," she went on.
"But the ship is still tumbling out of control,"
said the American boy who so fancied his own intelligence.
"Slow tumble," Tekla said. "Not problem. Plenty of time to fix now that perigee is raised."
"Fix it how? Marcus demolished three of the external thruster packages by ramming them. Who does that? Anyway, there are only two of them left. It's a basic reality of physics that you can't control a three-axis tumble using only two thrusters."
"Thank you for explaining basic reality," Tekla said. "Tumble can be eliminated by making scarfed nozzle."
This silenced them for a few moments. One of Julia's followers, Jian Yu, a Chinese Arky very passionate about going to Mars, looked like he understood it. Tekla nodded in his direction.
"This man will explain later. My time here is limited."
"Yes, Tekla, and we do appreciate that you've been able to make time for us at all," Julia said. Tekla wanted to slap her so much that her hand actually twitched. The sentence Julia had just spoken, had it been delivered in a different tone, might have actually meant what it said. Instead of which, it meant, "I am being callously ignored, and it's about time someone important came out to talk to me." Tekla had an almost physical sense of how that mentality was radiating outward from Julia to infect the other Arkies. Like almost everyone else in the Cloud Ark, Tekla was wearing a coverall with many pockets, compartments, external holsters, and the like. One of them contained a knife with a 4-inch, double-edged blade. Its tip could find JBF's heart easily. Tekla faded from the conversation briefly as she considered how to manage this. Julia probably wouldn't be expecting a frank assassination attempt, though you never really knew with people who had such minds. Tekla said,
"Would you like to report any difficulties with the San? Repeated outages have been observed."
Julia pressed her lips together in a satisfied way and looked toward Spencer Grindstaff.
"First I've heard of it,"
Spencer said. The statement was met with perfect deadpan silence. Tekla just waited. Soon the temptation to boast would get the better of them. Her training in tradecraft, in how to be a spy, had not been all that extensive. A few basic courses, some assigned reading. The reason was simple. She was too conspicuous to be useful as a spy, too similar to the Hollywood profile. Real spies went unnoticed. So they had kicked her out of the program and put her to work in roles, such as being an Olympic athlete, where her conspicuousness was an asset. But she had picked up a few general precepts, and she knew that this one thing, the urge to boast of one's accomplishments, had betrayed more secrets and destroyed more careers than anything else. She looked at Grindstaff. Unlike most people who soon broke eye contact, he looked right back at her, grinning.
"Unusual," Tekla said, "for one of your background."
"Sources and methods," he said.
"Then I will confine my remarks to what I came here for,"
Tekla said. This produced an immediate exchange of glances between Julia and Spencer. Tekla ignored it.
"For security reasons, it is imperative that we have accurate census of which person is in which arclet. Some people like to move around, to trade places. We understand. Fine. But safety and security problems are created when, for example, arclet is struck by bolide. Air is leaking. We do not know how many people are in it, their medical requirements, etc. Small person needs less air than big person."
Julia was nodding. "I take your point very clearly, Tekla. Speaking for the Arky community, I can confirm that a more informal mindset prevails out here on the outskirts. The perception of neglect by the powers that be on Izzy leads to a bit of a chip-on-the-shoulder attitude. Reshuffling of people between arklets seems like a harmless form of rebellion, but it's easy to overlook the safety issue that you are pointing out, which is a mistake. I will say that the confusion as to the real threat level we are under, as long as we
confine ourselves to dirty space,"
Ravi Kumar threw in. "Yes, thank you, Ravi. It just seems that one day we hear one thing, the next day we hear another."
"Statistics," Tekla said.
"Yes, that is what we are told again and again, but I can see no more," Tekla offered, and flicked her eyes at one of the small cameras mounted to the hull of the arklet. Julia held her gaze this time, and after a few moments threw a glance Spencer's way.
"Tekla, a minute ago we were dancing around the topic of the Situational Awareness Network, and Spencer was being a bit light-hearted, his sense of humor at work. But I feel comfortable telling you that, thanks to Spencer, We do have a way to disconnect from the San when we want to just have a normal conversation without wondering who might be listening in. And we have done so now. Anything you say here and now will not leave this arklet.
Tekla favored the circle of hangers-on and admirers with a long, slow, panoramic look, then actually rolled her eyes.
"Everyone out," Julia commanded. "You too, Spencer. Just Tekla and me."
"Your tradecraft is of low quality,"
Tekla said, when all the others had dispersed through the hamster tubes to the other arklets in Julia's heptad.
"I know," Julia said. "It is so difficult rebuilding an intelligence community from scratch. One must make do with the materials at hand. Their youth, their inexperience, and the openness they have come to expect from living their whole lives on the Internet all are inimical to doing things as they ought to be done. That is why we need more experienced hands, people who have learned the right instincts."
"It is not just that," Tekla said. "That is obvious."
"Oh?" Julia narrowed her eyes. "What have I missed that is not so obvious?"
"You should not trust Zeke Peterson with further information," Tekla said, "unless you wish to plant false intelligence, in which case he will be an effective channel."
Ivy and Zeke and Tekla had discussed it beforehand, and Zeke had cheerfully volunteered to be given up by Tekla as a supposed turncoat. It made little difference to him personally, and it would go a long way to cementing the idea, in Julia's mind, of Tekla as a master double agent. By Cold War standards, it was an obvious and amateurish gambit. But this was not the Cold War. This was a small town of 1,500 people with a former mayor who was trying to stir up trouble. Julia narrowed her eyes and nodded slowly. She was fascinated.
"I had wondered about him," she said. "He seemed like he was just playing along, just being polite."
"Not a problem with Tekla,"
Tekla said. Julia liked that. She had drifted closer and now reached out to touch Tekla's forearm briefly.
"I like that about you, Tekla. What I see is what I get."
"Yes."
Then, after a somewhat uneasy silence, Tekla added,
"You play long game. Patient."
"To a degree," Julia said. And suddenly her face and attitude had changed, as if her face had been recast in painted steel. "We cannot afford to be patient for very long. Marcus's death has changed everything. Until that tragic event, the members of the Archie community could look forward to the return of the great leader. Ivy was a mere caretaker. Her shortcomings could be overlooked. Now, awareness is spreading through the swarm that Marcus is not coming back. Ivy is back in power. Sal will quote from obscure clauses in the Constitution to legitimize her status. But true legitimacy comes from the support of the governed. She'll be moving now to solidify her hold on the reins. It's at such a time that small, symbolic gestures can have the greatest effect. And that, Tekla, is why the next few days are such a critical time for us. Perhaps Ymir will pull through, perhaps not. We can't afford to wait. Preparations are afoot. 3 days from now, Arklets will begin to break free of the Cloud Ark and begin their epic trek to high orbit. The powers that be might fear to implement the pure swarm strategy for the loss of control it will mean for them, but the Arky community, tired of huddling behind an ineffective shield, slowly being decimated by the hard rain, knows no such limitations.
Survival of the breakaway group will demonstrate the falsity of the G-Pop's predictions of danger,
Tekla said, nodding.
The power of the center will be broken.
For the first time, the Cloud Ark Constitution will truly come into effect, Julia said. Notwithstanding the sophistry of the apologist Saul Guodian, that Constitution, Tekla, as I'm sure you know, calls for the formation of a security force. Not the Praetorian Guard that Marcus cobbled together, but something real. I can think of no one better qualified than you to command it.
Hook, line, and sinker. said Spencer Grindstaff, as he and Julia watched Tekla's flivver depart with a staccato series of thruster burns.
Well, she definitely bought it,
Julia admitted. But I don't like the note of triumphalism in your voice, Spencer. What we have really learned is that Ivy is a formidable opponent. Somehow she has managed to get people like Tekla on her side, and they have come up with a fairly elaborate strategy for penetrating our organization. Grindstaff shrugged.
As these things go, it's not that elaborate. Kind of obvious, really.
Easy to say, Julia said. Given that you have a bug hidden in the banana, and we knew everything they were going to do. But lacking that information, Spencer, do you really think we'd have seen through it?
I thought Tekla did a marvelous job.
You need to look out for her. She really hates you. And she's carrying at least one weapon.
Thanks to Pete Starling, Julia said. So am I.
She reached into her bag and drew out a small revolver, just far enough that Spencer could see the butt of its grip, then slid it back in.
At the risk of insulting your intelligence, Spencer said, I would like to remind you of the consequences of firing that thing inside of a space vehicle.
No offense taken. I've actually seen those consequences. And you know what? The air doesn't leak out that fast. Anyway, I'm told that the rounds in this weapon are designed to mushroom on impact, so they are less likely to exit the body.
That's great, Spencer said, provided you actually hit a body.
If it comes down to me and Tekla, Julia said, I'm not going to miss.
All Dinah wanted to do was sleep. Since New Caird had departed from Izzy, she had never gotten more than 4 consecutive hours, and the numbers for the last day or so were even more dismal. In a weird way, she wanted to sleep so that she would be able to grieve properly. She knew Marcus was dead, but it hadn't really sunk in. Nor would it, as long as she was running from one crisis to the next. The burn had worked. Ymir's perigee altitude had been raised to the point where it would never again be troubled by the atmosphere. But the ship was still tumbling, albeit slowly. And Vyacheslav was still trudging around on its outer surface with his feet zip-tied to grabs. At the start of this extravehicular activity, Slava had exited through the airlock on the side of New Caird, a ship that was no longer with them. His supplies were running low. He had to get inside the command module before he ran out of air. This could be achieved using an airlock built in for that purpose. It was located adjacent to the docking port in the nose of the ice-buried command module. Passing through it, he would enter the uppermost level of the module, where he could breathe the same air as everyone else. But he had taken the precaution of checking himself out with an inspector and found powerful radiation coming from several locations on his suit. Basically, wherever he had come into contact with the surface of the shard.
I was worried about this, Jiro said, but there was nothing to be done.
Worried about what? Dinah asked. I thought the surface was reasonably clean.
It was, Jiro said. Until we did the perigee burn. The nozzle was pointed forward. Some of the steam was blown back over us by the wind, by the atmosphere we were passing through. It condensed and stuck to the surface of the shard, so now there are little pieces of fallout all over the outside of Ymir, and some of them have gotten stuck to Slava's spacesuit.
He's got to get out of that thing.
Jiro shrugged. The suit will block most of the beta. I mean, he's got to get out of it before he runs out of oxygen.
That is true.
Which means he has to come in here. Also true.
He's going to bring that radiation inside with him.
It will take weeks to kill us. By that time, we will have accomplished our mission. Or not.
In the end, though, they came up with a workaround that did not involve dying, which was that they taped some plastic over the companionway that joined the command module's top level to the one below it. Before doing so, they moved a generous supply of food and water to that level, along with toiletries, a sleep sack, and other items Vyacheslav would be needing. Slava passed through the airlock with some minutes to spare, doffed his suit, and closed it up in the chamber of the airlock, which would block most of the beta radiation coming off it. He then stripped off his clothes and went through several repetitions of decontaminating himself with pre-moistened towelettes, throwing all of it into the airlock chamber before slamming its hatch shut. Then he threw up. The upper level of the command module, along with Slava himself, now had to be treated as contaminated, but they didn't need it anymore. Jiro and Dinah would be confined to the lower levels, separated from Vyacheslav and the possible contamination by a sheet of plastic, until they reached Izzy or died. A common air supply circulated through all the levels in ducts, but it had a filter system which they hoped would catch any floating motes of fallout. Having seen to all of those matters, they turned out the lights and slept. Dinah slept through her alarm, in fact, and finally woke up to realize she'd been out for 12 hours. Her next thought was to wonder where Marcus was. Then she remembered, with a kind of astonishment, that he was dead. It came as a stinging slap, followed by grief. But on the heels of the grief came a feeling of deep fear that she had rarely experienced in all the time since Zero. It was not the sharp, bracing fear one felt on an adventure, such as the ride through Perigee, nor the kind of intellectual, abstract fear that had been with them ever since Dube had predicted the hard rain. This was a kind of morbid panic that was second cousin to depression. It was how a child might feel upon learning that she had been orphaned. Not a child, rather, but an adolescent, the oldest sibling, on whom responsibility for the family now fell. Marcus was gone. He wasn't going to shoulder any more burdens for them. Others would have to take up those burdens, and some of those, the ones perhaps most eager to step into Marcus's place, would certainly make the wrong decisions. And so, as sad as Dinah felt about the fact that she would never see Marcus again or feel his embrace, the thing that really made her want to contract into a fetal position was this knowledge that it was on her now. On her and Ivy and Dube and the others who could be trusted. She went up into the common room and found Jiro, as usual, lost in contemplation of arcane plots on his computer screen, reflected in miniature on the lenses of his bifocals. During the year he had been in space, his prescription had changed, and so he had been the first consumer of the optical lens-grinding machine that had been sent up and installed in Izzy. Without it, much of the Cloud Ark's population would gradually have been rendered non-productive as their eyeglasses were broken or wore out. It was a military machine capable of making glasses in one style and one style only. At some point, a few years down the road, everyone who needed glasses would be wearing this style. It was interesting to contemplate how many decades or centuries would have to go by before the population had grown and the economy developed to the point where it could support an eyewear industry with different styles. He looked up at her through the milky reflections. "I let you sleep," he said. "Your robots seem to be working fine. There is nothing to do until I finish these calculations." "And then what?"
"We have to eliminate the last of the tumbling," Jiro said, "before we make the final breaking burns."
For Dinah, that was all clear. Ymir was in a safe orbit now and would not fall into the atmosphere anytime soon. But she was still going much too fast and way too high to rendezvous with Izzy. They needed to finish the execution of the same plan they'd had all along, which was to make one or two more breaking burns as Ymir passed through her perigee, slowing her down to the point where a rendezvous with Izzy was feasible. This required getting the nozzle pointed forward again, and keeping it that way.
"How much damage was done to the—"
"They were destroyed," Jiro said. "We have two remaining."
They were both referring to the thruster packages, embedded in the ice, that would normally have been used to manage the shard's attitude.
"It is fine. It was necessary.
Jiro added, almost as if worried that Dinah would think poorly of him for criticizing the decisions made by a dead commander. Can more be sent out from? Jiro nodded. It is possible to assemble a MIV that could rendezvous with us and assist with the problem, just in case my idea does not succeed. But since our radio link was lost with New Caird, we cannot coordinate this. And what is your idea? We can use your robots to alter the shape of the nozzle exit, Jiro said. He held up one hand like a blade, pointed toward the ceiling, and then flexed his knuckles slightly, indicating a shallow bend. Make it asymmetrical. Like a scarfed nozzle. Exactly. When we fire the main propulsion, it will give us an off-axis thrust. If the scarf is oriented correctly, it will have tremendous control authority. Maybe too much, Dinah said. We'll end up overcorrecting. One thing at a time, Jiro said. We scarf the nozzle, we do a little correction, we scarf it the other way, we kill the rotation. It might take several repetitions. It can be done. I have been modeling it. Dinah pulled herself into position before her triptych of flat panels and began opening windows, checking on the activities of her menagerie of robots, some sunning themselves on the outside to soak up power, others sipping juice from the reactors, some mining propellant for the next burn, others mending the nozzle. The latter group, mostly gnats, would be responsible for the nozzle sculpting program. Until now, having an asymmetrical nozzle, delivering thrust at an off angle, had been a problem to be avoided, not a feature to be encouraged. Jiro had emailed her some diagrams of what the nozzle bell would need to look like. The alterations were surprisingly minor. In an engine that produced that much power, a little bit of off-axis thrust went a long way. "When's our next perigee?" she asked. "We just went through one, so about 8 hours from now." The paramount duty of the Cloud Ark's commander, so important that Marcus had broken character and described it to Ivy as sacred, was to stay on top of the bolide scan, which was a feed of information synthesized out of all of Izzy's long-range radars and optical telescopes. A disproportionate number of GPOP members devoted their lives to managing this, or to maintaining the equipment used to produce it. Because the stream of data was continuous, it needed to be broken down for the consumption of someone like Marcus or Ivy into reports that showed up on their screens at regular intervals. A triurnal bolide scan was issued at the top of each shift, .0, .8, and .16. Ivy read one of them when she woke up, another in the middle of her afternoon, and the third just before going to sleep. Each of these summarized what was known about bolides that might come near them during the next 8 hours, and made recommendations as to what maneuvers the Cloud Ark should execute in order to avoid them. Typically, they made small burns several times a day for this purpose. The policy was default go, which meant that the maneuver would be promulgated to the Cloud Ark via perambulator and carried out automatically, unless the commander vetoed it. The only reason this was ever likely to happen was in cases where two dangerous rocks were headed their way at about the same time and they needed to make a decision. Such events had occurred twice during the hard rain so far, but they had been simulated and wargamed hundreds of times before that. The name of the game was to avoid getting cornered. To be detected 8 hours in advance, a bolide had to be pretty big. Smaller ones came along all the time and weren't picked up on the radars until minutes or even seconds before collision. Accordingly, smaller reports were issued at the top of every hour, listing all noteworthy rocks that had been detected during the last 60 minutes. This covered most of them, so the commander, or whoever covered for her while she was sleeping, could discharge most of her responsibilities in read the bolide scan by dropping everything else she was doing at the top of each hour and reading it. From time to time, however, they would become aware of a hot rock, or streaker, that had surprised them by coming in from a weird angle, or at unusually high speed. And then the commander would be notified immediately,
so that an alert could be issued and evasive action could be seen to. The streaker alerts combined elements of the small-town Midwestern tornado siren with the red alert from Star Trek. All sleeping people were awakened, all non-essential personnel were evacuated from the larger tori, which were considered most vulnerable, and hatches were closed between different sections, in case of a breach. Similar precautions were taken by the Arkies. Arklets were, of course, more vulnerable to bolide strikes, but they were also more maneuverable. As the hot rock drew closer and its orbital parameters were determined more precisely, the data would be fed to Perambulator. Any arklets in danger of being hit would be identified, and a collective solution would be calculated that would enable them to move into safer trajectories without banging into anyone else. These events happened, on average, between 1 and 2 times a day, but as always, the devil was in the statistical details. They had once gone 3 days without a single streaker. On another occasion, they'd had 5 of them within a 12-hour period. The first of these events had caused an upwelling of chatter on Spacebook to the effect that the powers that be were overstating the threat in order to cow the Arkies into submission. And the second had generated a hard-hitting blog post from Tav Prowse calling the G-pop on the carpet for systematic incompetence. It was in the wake of such an alert, while cleaning up her desktop of post-action chatter, that Ivy's attention was drawn to a post that had just come up on Tav's blog. An interview with Ulrika Eck.
Ulrika has a lot to learn about bloggers,
was Ivy's verdict, after she'd finished reading it. She shook her head.
You'd think she, of all people, would know. She's been through PR training.
These remarks were delivered to a banana that had been slowly repopulating itself during the last few minutes, with people who had been called away on other duties during the streaker alert. Tekla was the last to arrive, bringing Tom Van Meter and other members of Marcus's security detail in her wake. Louisa and Sal were already present in the room. Doob had just texted his regrets, explaining that he needed to crunch some numbers about what had just happened. "She probably dropped her guard," Louisa suggested, thinking she was just chatting informally.
"You've read it, then?"
"I scanned it."
"Referring to what?"
Tekla asked. Ulrika made a few off-the-cuff remarks about swarm theory and which strategies we might wish to pursue in the future, and Tav is blowing them up into a cause célèbre, Ivy said.
What, if anything, would you like to do about it?
Sal asked.
Nothing, Ivy said. Look, the longer this thing with Ymir continues, the more anxiety people have about the big ride. Every time a hot rock comes in, it juices up that anxiety for a little while. Well, either it'll work or it won't. If it doesn't work, then we have very little choice anyway. We have to dump and run.
Sal nodded.
But if it does work, it'll change everything about the way people think.
Ivy nodded.
Yeah, and I'm growing certain that it will. Even if the scarfed nozzle gambit fails, we still have that MIV we can send out as a backup plan. I think that in a week, we'll have a successful rendezvous with Ymir and we'll be prepping for the big ride.
Ivy made a gesture, indicating that the new arrivals should find places for themselves around the table.
Which brings me to the topic of this meeting, she continued. We know what JBF's plan is. She's recruiting some number of Arkies willing to strike out on their own. The general scheme seems to be that they'll get a few arklets stocked with provisions for a few weeks' journey. Then, on a signal, they'll break away from Izzy and make burns that will take them to a higher orbit. An orbit that we can't reach without expending a lot of propellant. We don't know what their long-term plan is, or if they even have one, but I think Julia is basically playing the odds that these people will survive long enough to send back messages saying, "Come on in, the water's fine," and encourage other Arkies to follow suit. They all know that they can't really be pursued once they have departed the swarm. Membership in the Cloud Ark is, under the current state of affairs, voluntary.
I infer you mean to change that? Louisa asked dryly, casting her gaze over Tekla and the members of the squad.
They can't make a break for it without hoarding certain critical supplies, Ivy said. We can't allow people to just ransack our storage facilities for whatever they want, and we have clear evidence that this has been happening. There's traffic on Spacebook about where to look if you want to score a box of fresh batteries or scrubber cartridges. So our basic approach to this is going to be simple. We've identified the worst offenders, where hoarding is concerned. I'm going to make an announcement in an hour explaining how the Cloud Ark Constitution works when it comes to theft of public supplies. And I'm going to offer a 24-hour amnesty during which anyone can turn in stuff they have been hoarding. As soon as that time is up, Tekla and her team are going to move on one arklet that we know is being used as a storage dump for contraband, and they are going to restore order. And then Sal will step in as prosecutor and take whatever action he deems justified. How can you put people in jail when they are already confined to tin cans? Louisa asked. How can you find them when there's no money?
We will have to evolve solutions as we go, Sal said.
Tekla stared him down, then drew her thumb across her throat.
Well, that seems definitive, Julia said.
She and Spencer Grindstaff were hovering in the middle of the white arklet. Drifting near them was a laptop whose speakers had been playing the audio feed from the banana. They could hear the sounds of the meeting breaking up and people separating into smaller conversations as they moved out of the room. Spencer pulled it closer and whacked the volume button a few times to mute the sound.
As I said before, hook, line, and sinker.
Unless, Julius said, they are somehow aware of the fact that we have surveillance on the banana and everything we just heard was a sort of radio play staged for our benefit.
Spencer beamed.
Now that is paranoid. I thought I had it bad, but...
Just kidding, Julia said a little too quickly. This is actionable, Spencer. I believe we are justified in taking everything we just heard at face value, which means I am comfortable giving good news to the Martians. Are they ready?
Yes, they've been waiting,
Spencer said, and thumbed out a text message to summon them. The Martians all had to come via the same hamster tube. So it took a few moments for the core members of the first human expedition to the Red Planet to filter in. Dr. Catherine Quine, whose professional role was obvious, Ravi Kumar, who would be the expedition's commander, Li Jianyu, who would act as a general science officer, and Paul Friel, an American MIV expert, the head engineer. They, as well as a score of other Arkies waiting in the wings, had sworn an oath that they'd not spend the rest of their lives sealed up in tin cans, but would walk on the surface of Mars or die in the attempt. In their wake came several other members of Julia's staff. Julia opened the meeting with a few words of greeting and a solemn announcement to the effect that the Mars mission was a go. Once the ensuing round of zero-G high-fives and embraces had trailed off into an awkward silence, she singled out Paul Friel. Paul, no doubt you've briefed these others on the very latest while you were so patiently cooling your heels. But might I know what has been going on with the MIV?
Of course, Madam President. As you know, they're trying to stabilize Ymir with...
A Rube Goldberg scheme in the form of an ice sculpture. Yes, I know about that.
Paul chuckled, showing a lot of gum.
Not surprisingly, the powers that be are a little nervous about that, and so word came down from on high that we ought to be preparing a backup plan, so we can go pull Ymir's fat from the fire if need be. Well, that couldn't be better from a Martian point of view. As you know, we have been planning this mission for years. After Zero, I kept it going as a side project all through the development of the MIV program, and we managed to grease it in as one of the use cases.
Use cases?
One of the hypothetical uses to which the MIV kit might eventually be put,
Spencer explained.
Basically, it just gave us an excuse to include a few components, like throttleable landing engines and aeroshield material, that might not have made it in otherwise.
Paul went on.
So stabilizing Red Rover's design has been a piece of cake.
Red Rover?
Yeah, that's what we're calling her.
I would like to propose something a little more suggestive of a higher purpose, Julia said. Spearhead or some such thing. This led to an uneasy silence, terminated by Camilla, who said, I'll drop a list of options and submit it to you right away, Madam President.
Thank you, Camilla.
You understand, Paul, that this mission will have symbolic as well as scientific value, and we want to send the right message to the other Arkies so that they will feel inspired to follow in her wake.
Of course. Consider it a working title only, Paul said. A code name.
It's not even good as a code name,
Spencer pointed out,
because anyone can...
Let's move on, Julia said. You were talking, Paul, about the design.
Done. It took like a man day. We just had to make a few tweaks to a pre-existing use case to reflect the materials and supplies we actually had on hand.
Excellent.
But a design is not a ship, of course, Paul continued, and until a couple of days ago it would have been pretty darn hard to put the actual propulsion system together without bringing down the wrath of Ivy.
That is not a phrase calculated to strike fear into the heart of anyone except those most worshipful of her authority, Julia remarked, speaking with the gravity that could only be summoned by one who had recently used nuclear weapons on live targets. Paul cackled.
You know what I'm saying, though. Everything happens in a fishbowl here. So, you can imagine the grin on my face when we got the order to begin assembling the Ymir Rescue MIV.
Are the specifications similar?
Similar enough. They can both use the same main engine. The thruster packages, the control systems, life support, all of that stuff is completely standardized. It doesn't change from one use case to another. It's just a matter of punching different parameters into the code. It's just a config file.
Seeing that Julia didn't necessarily know what a config file was, Spencer put in,
They can essentially download the DNA, if you will, of Red Rover, or whatever they end up calling it, into the Ymir rescue vehicle with a few keystrokes.
Satisfied with that, Julia asked, What of the Arklets, the Heptad and the Triad?
Well, they're already functional, independent space vehicles. Way more than enough space for 24 Martians and their vitamins. Obviously, we've been stocking up,
Paul said, waving his hands around at the bags of food and other supplies crowding the white Arklet.
Yes, Julia said, but the critical part of the operation is going to be moving them from their default positions in the swarm, which will seem unremarkable as far as Perambulator is concerned, to the propulsion stack that you have been assembling. And that's going to make a hell of a stink, is it not?
The smile on Paul Friel's face became a bit frozen.
We could just go for it, he said.
I have a workaround,
said Spencer Grindstaff.
I think we can make this happen. A streaker alert is all we need. It'll go down tomorrow.
How do you know there's going to be a streaker alert?
Such an event is nothing, Spencer said. Other than a particular configuration of bits.
Dinah had been dreaming of Mars. As an asteroid miner, she had never been that interested in the distant and inhospitable red planet. The politics of the pre-zero space exploration world had obliged her to show skepticism, even disdain, toward those who wanted to go there and build colonies and terraform the planet. Mars colonists were siphoning attention and resources away from the asteroid miners, who wanted to use easier-to-get-to resources to make much more human-friendly habitats. Space colonies, rotating to provide full gravity, with plenty of water and fresh air. In any event, it had been a dead issue for 2 years. But that didn't prevent Mars from showing up in her dreams, and now infiltrating her daydreams. Almost 3 years now had gone by since she had walked on the surface of a planet, looked up into a sky, seen a horizon. Intellectually, she knew that death would take her, sooner or later, before she did any of those things again. She and everyone else in the Cloud Ark would live out their lives in environments resembling bomb shelters, hospital basements, and research labs. The best they could hope for was to look out a small window at the starry sky,
The view of the blue, green, and white earth had once provided fascination and solace. The orange ball of fire they now circled was such a disagreeable sight that most people actively avoided looking at it. No one was ever going back there. For those who still aspired to go for a walk before dying of old age, Mars was the only hope, be it ever so impractical. People had been talking about it on Spacebook and on some of the blogs that had been cropping up on the New Ark's miniature internet. Before the loss of New Caird had severed Ymir's data link to the Cloud Ark, some of it had trickled through to her tablet, and Dinah read it in idle moments. At least she had some idle moments now. Since the decision to try the scarfed nozzle approach, they had executed two burns, about 24 hours apart, each with a slightly different configuration of the ice nozzle, a canted lip constructed by the gnat swarm, projecting almost imperceptibly above the aft surface of the shard and bending the torrent of steam slightly. The first of those burns had gotten them spinning the way they wanted to go, though spinning might be too strong a word for a rotation that took the better part of a day. During that day, the gnats had decamped to the other side of the nozzle's rim and built a lip there. The second burn, then, had stopped the rotation that the first one had started and brought them close enough to their desired attitude that the surviving thrusters could handle the details. Another perigee was coming up soon. This time the nozzle would be aimed the way they wanted it. Forward, once again turning the nuclear engine into a powerful retro-rocket. The robots on the inside of the shard had been at work scooping it out, sculpting the walnut shell architecture that, according to the structural engineering simulations, would enable the whole thing to hold together during the last round of maneuvers. The hoppers were full of ice, with more on the way, and they'd finally learned how to make the system work consistently. Part of that lesson was not to try to accomplish too much with any one burn. It was better to take it easy, to set a reasonable Delta V target, get it done and lock it down, then take stock of the situation and plan the next burn at leisure. Consequently, their rendezvous with Izzy looked to be happening much later than they'd first expected, and almost every day brought a further postponement. But at the same time, it came to seem more and more of a sure thing, less of a wild chance, and this began to affect Dinah's thinking. Her robots were doing their work almost entirely on autopilot, leaving her somewhat bored. Vyacheslav, sealed up on the other side of a wall of plastic, could be talked to, but preferred keeping to himself. Jiro, on the other hand, had been working almost around the clock and been showing signs of strain. Dinah would find excuses to float behind him and look over his shoulder at his screen. Was he playing solitaire? Running orbital mechanics simulations? Writing his memoirs? He seemed mostly to be looking at video feeds of machinery. By process of elimination, this had to be near the core of the reactor. In the floor of the bottommost level, three stories below them, was a manhole giving way to a shaft sunk into the ice. At the far end of that shaft was another hatch providing access to what, on an ocean-going ship of old Earth, would have been called the boiler room. A small pressurized compartment housed control panels and access ports connected to the reactor, which was only a few meters away on the other side of a heavy wall. The wall was a radiation shield, at least in theory. But sending up a huge piece of lead hadn't been an option for the hastily assembled Ymir expedition, and so the boiler room got washed with neutrons and gamma rays whenever the reactor was used. The radiation detectors that Sean and company had left behind, the last time they'd closed that hatch, didn't leave much to the imagination. The place was a hellhole now. Fortunately, all the systems connected there had been designed to be operated remotely from the safety of the command module, so there was no need to go down that ice tunnel and open that hatch. Their instruments told them they were nearing perigee again. Jiro, assisted by Dinah, executed what they hoped would be the second-to-last burn of the big engine. This went on longer than Jiro had predicted, but it seemed to work. Ymir shed most of her excess velocity. Her orbit, at apogee, was now only a few hundred kilometers higher than Izzy's. In spite of attrition suffered by the robots as they wore out, broke, or succumbed to radiation damage, Dinah still had enough of them to restock the hoppers for the final major burn, which they calculated would be happening at a perigee a few hours later. "If you are satisfied with the disposition of your robots," Jiro said, "I would like to show you how to operate the main propulsion." She had grown up in mining camps where older men liked to amuse her, and themselves, by teaching her how to operate heavy machinery, blow things up with dynamite, pilot airplanes, and the like. So Jiro's offer didn't seem unusual to her at first. Teaching people how to do stuff was, among other things, a way to alleviate boredom. But over the course of the next hour, it slowly became clear to her that Jiro really was expecting her to operate the engine during the upcoming burn. It might have been the language barrier, but his English was pretty good, and he was being quite persistent in saying things like, "You will keep an eye on this thermocouple," and "You might see some flutter in this valve." "If you don't hear from me beyond the 30-second mark," he said at one point, "then you are on your own and you will have to initiate shutdown based on observed Delta V." "Why would I not hear from you?" Dinah asked. "Where are you going to be?" "In the boiler room," Jiro said. "Why would you go there?" "Some of the control blade actuators have stopped responding," he said. "I think that the electronics have been damaged by radiation. It's okay. We have replacements. But they will have to be installed manually." "So you're going to go down there?" "Yes," Jiro said. "And that is where I am going to stay."
"It is, for all intents and purposes, empty,"
Tekla reported over an encrypted voice link to Ivy.
"Empty of people. Empty of supplies."
She, Tom Van Meter, and Bowler Erdina had spent the last 10 minutes searching Arklet 98, from front door to boiler room, under the eye of Sal Guodian. They had arrived via Flivver, docked, and entered 98 without incident. Sal had gone through first, carrying a tablet on which was displayed the first search warrant ever issued under the provisions of the Cloud Ark Constitution. He had been ready to show it to the first person who challenged him, but no one was here. Tekla, Tom, and Beau had then come in, wearing orange vests improvised from survival kits that, since they'd been designed for use on Earth, had no practical utility anymore. These would serve as police uniforms until something else could be stitched together. With any luck, they wouldn't be needing a lot of cop gear. But Ivy had been clear, and the others in her ad hoc council had agreed, that if they were executing what amounted to a police action, they couldn't beat around the bush, couldn't try to palm it off as an informal visit. A new constitution had to be exercised, or it was just words.
"Can you get it back on the San?"
Ivy asked, over the voice link. "I'd like to see what's happening."
"I'll reboot everything,"
Sal said, pulling himself up into the control couch.
"But it depends on what Spencer did, whether he broke it permanently or just entered a temporary command."
He reached around in back of a panel, felt for a connector, pulled it out, and jacked it back in.
"We had estimated that you were going to find 10 person-years worth of non-renewables in that thing,"
Ivy said. She meant not bulk food, which could be grown in the outer hull space of an arklet, or air, which was renewed by the life support system, but generally smaller items, like toiletries, vitamins, medicine, and specialty food.
"That was based on circumstantial evidence, the amount of stuff that's gone missing, the number of Flivver trips and EVAs that have touched that arklet. We always knew it was only a guess, but for it to contain nothing at all is odd."
"More than odd," Tekla said. "Surprise attack."
"You think there's going to be an attack?"
Maybe not in sense of violent assault,
Tekla said, but something.
And Arklet 98 was a decoy,
obviously.
A musical tone sounded from the Arklet's PA speakers, and the white LEDs changed their hue to red.
Alert, said a synthesized voice. All personnel should now be awake and at stations for urgent swarm maneuver. This is not a drill.
They'd heard it before. It was a streaker alert. Normally, though, they took it at face value.
Remarkable coincidence,
Tekla said.
I think you guys had better get back in the flivver,
Ivy said.
Follow the usual procedures for one of these, but keep your eyes open.
Steve, do you have anything yet on the bolide?
Ivy asked. They were about 5 minutes into the alert, which had obliged them to move down into the banana. As much as Ivy wanted to know what was happening with JBF and what Tekla had characterized as a surprise attack, her responsibility in a case like this one was clear. All of her attentions had to be focused on the evasive maneuvers being carried out by the Cloud Ark and their possible consequences. Those might include collisions between arklets or the separation of one or more arklets from the swarm. In dire cases, it might be necessary to send out rescue teams, which was why her first act had been to get Tekla and the others into their flivver. For the normal role of that makeshift police service was not to serve warrants on hoarders. It was to respond to emergencies. As keenly as the space geek in Ivy's soul wanted to pay attention to the scientific phenomenon of the incoming rock, it was a task she had to delegate. And she delegated it to Steve Lake as soon as the alert had sounded. Thus far, the alert had been proceeding as most of them did, which meant that most network activity had been shut down to leave open bandwidth for Perambulator. That system swung into action without human intervention, calculating courses, making suggestions, and gathering data about what the motes in the data cloud were doing. The Perambulator screens were looking pretty angry, but that was normal as almost every arklet fired its thrusters and shunted into a new trajectory. In time, it would get sorted out. It always did. But part of the sorting out process was refining what they knew about the trajectory of the incoming streaker. The closer it came, the more precisely they could track it. By the time it passed through, or near, the swarm, they'd have its parameters dialed in to high precision. And once it had flashed by, all Perambulator had to do was clean up the mess. Ivy had asked Steve about the bolide for a couple of reasons. One was that hot rocks, by definition, tended to come and go rapidly. This one had been approaching for several minutes, a long time to wait. Another was that Perambulator looked more chaotic than usual. Normally, there would be a spray of red in the first couple of minutes. Presently, it would begin to fade as the arklets reported that they were out of harm's way. But in this case, it never seemed to get any better.
Are we having trouble with bandwidth, or...
The rock is weird,
Steve said.
Normally, I'd expect to see a stream of packets from SI, refining the params as they gathered more data.
He meant sensor integration, the department that managed the radars and telescopes.
And you're not.
Well, I am, but with different numbers.
What do you mean, different numbers?
It's like we have two different streaker alerts happening at once. The packets are stepping on each other. There's some kind of crosstalk going on.
Steve sat back from his screen for a moment and tugged his beard.
Just a sec, he said. I think that these packets are coming from different sources.
But they should all have the same point of origination, Ivy said. SI.
They claim to, Steve said. But I think that some of them are forgeries.
Feeling his chair shift subtly beneath him, he reached out involuntarily with one hand and held the edge of the table. Izzy was firing her thrusters, coming about to a new orientation, trying to put Amalthea between herself and the bolide, real or imagined.
You think this whole alert is them spoofing us?
It would fit with Tekla's theory of what's going on, Steve said.
I'll try to voice with Dube,
Ivy said.
Work on that forgery hypothesis.
Madam President,
Camilla said, pulling a headphone away from her ear.
As you requested, I am informing you that Ivy has figured it out.
She knows? Julia asked.
Not quite, but Steve Lake has detected the forged packets and is running further analysis.
Camilla's eyes were big, and her voice, which was always somewhat impaired by her facial injuries, was thick and dry.
Julia threw her a shrewd look, then turned to Spencer Grindstaff, who shrugged.
Sooner or later, a man of Steve's talents was bound to...
I don't care about that, Julia cut in. I want to know whether our gambit has bought us enough time. There's...
Camilla began. Spencer ran Camilla off the road.
It has bought us enough confusion. We should be in position to dock this heptad at the shipyard in 20 seconds.
There's another bolide,
Camilla squeaked,
I think.
Julia shook her off, keeping her focus on Spencer.
Where is the triad?
Already there,
Spencer said.
The spacewalkers? Suited up, out of the airlocks, in position.
Still, the assembly, the integration, it will take time.
Madam President, if I may.
Paul Friel broke in.
All we need is to slap her together, with zip ties if that's what it takes, and achieve separation from the shipyard. A small thruster burn will do it. Izzy doesn't have phasers to blast us out of the sky. They could send a flivver after us, but what are they going to do? All we need is to get clear. Then we can spend days prepping Red Hope before we embark on the mission in earnest.
I wouldn't put anything past that Tekla.
Say what you will about her. She'll follow orders,
Paul said.
Well, as a stay-behind supporter of your expedition, I will be happy to run interference for you until you can get cleanly away,
Julia said. Through the heptad structure, a programmed series of whirs and clunks resonated as it docked with a port on the long truss projecting to the side of the caboose, the heart of the shipyard, rich in airlocks and anchoring points. Docked at the next port along was a glinting, angular framework, the skeleton of Red Hope, awaiting its final components. It sported four large propellant tanks, clustered around a knot of pumps, valves, actuators, and sensors that fed a rocket engine centered below.
Madam President, Ravi asked, I am afraid the time is now, unless you want to go to Mars, which you would be welcome to do.
Julia snapped to attention. She had been checking herself in the mirror of her compact. Hardly glamorous, but by Cloud Arc standards, her appearance would do.
It is tempting, Julia said, but I have responsibilities here, I'm afraid.
She snapped the compact shut and glanced over,
verifying that Camilla was ready to shoot video on her phone.
She was, but she still had that rattled look on her face. What had come over her? They'd have to have a heart-to-heart later.
Very well,
Ravi said, with a note of regret that sounded only a little forced. Perhaps you'll be wanting this. He held out a sheet of paper. Taking it from him, Julia recognized it as the presidential seal, much the worse for wear. Ravi had carefully peeled it from the wall, bringing most of its rectangle of blue tape with it. Julia smoothed it out and tucked it under one arm. Drifting slowly away from her, Ravi snapped out a salute. Julia returned it.
Godspeed, Ravi. I look forward to hearing your first transmission from the surface of Mars.
And I look forward to sending it, Madam President.
We shall meet again, I feel. Somehow the intrepid people of the Cloud Arc will find a way, in spite of all opposition, to win through to the realm of clean space and follow Red Hope to a better place.
Ravi was one of those who could never quite tell when he was being dismissed. He began to mumble out a stirring response,
but Julia glanced at Camilla to let her know that she could stop recording, then propelled herself toward the nose of the white arclet. Camilla followed in her wake.
After a few moments of squirming through tubes, they emerged from the port into one of the modules that made up the shipyard. It was something of a madhouse. The total roster of the Red Hope expedition was 24.
most of those were already aboard the Heptad or the Triad, waiting to be mated with the vehicle's frame. But a few were outside in spacesuits, and several were in here, engaging in hasty conferences or shoving bundles of supplies about. Adding a bizarre note were four members of the general population, apparently shipyard workers, who had been zip-tied, hands behind backs, to convenient attachment points around the inside of the module. Most looked fine, but one man had a stream of small blood globules drifting away from a laceration on his eyebrow. Paul Friel had mentioned in passing that several of the MIV team had become unwitting accomplices, helping to assemble the frame of Red Hope on the understanding that it was part of a backup plan to rescue Ymir. Apparently, they had changed status to witting and raised objections. The bleeding man was staring at Julia through the eye that hadn't swollen shut.
"Julia!"
he called out. In an odd way, Julia had nothing to do. The other Martians were busy shoving their hoarded supplies through the port into the Heptad. One by one, the Martians were following suit, and so the space was rapidly clearing out. She ignored the bleeding man at first, but it got to the point where only one Martian, Paul Friel himself, was remaining. Lacking Ravi's feel for ceremony, he was checking off items on the screen of his tablet, paying Julia no attention whatsoever.
"Julia!"
the zip-tied man said again. He wasn't shouting. His tone was almost conversational.
"Yes?"
she finally said.
"What's your friend's name?"
he asked, nodding toward Camilla.
Julia bridled for a moment at the impertinent request,
then remembered that it was never too late to turn an enemy into a friend.
"Her name is Camilla," she said.
"And let me say, sir, that I am shocked and dismayed to see what has occurred to you. Let me assure you that—"
"Hey, Camilla," the man said.
"Yes?"
Camilla answered, sounding very much the scared 18-year-old girl.
"Your friend is crazy," the man told her.
"Madam President,"
Paul asked, before Julia had time to react. She turned toward Paul, her face burning.
"If you would do the honors."
"What honors? Honestly, these engineers, was she supposed to break a bottle of champagne over it?"
"Close the hatch when I've gone through. Then we can undock."
"Happy to."
"See you on Mars."
He stuck his hand out. She grasped it lightly and gave it a little shake. Camilla, rattled by the exchange with the bleeding man, had forsaken her duties as camera operator. Paul Friel reached into the portal, joining Earth to Mars, pulled himself through, turned about, and closed the hatch on his side. Julia followed suit on hers. Immediately she felt, as much as heard, the hisses and clunks that signaled the undocking of Red Hope. Unfamiliar noises radiated through the module's hull, too, very close to her, and she realized that these were the boots of spacesuits moving around.
"The alert is canceled,"
announced a synthetic voice. The color of the lights changed. Camilla emitted a short, explosive scream. Then she pointed down the length of the shipyard toward where it connected with the stack. Down in the caboose, some 30 meters away, a few people could be seen, dressed in orange vests. One of them looked directly at her. It was Tekla. The synthesized voice spoke out again, sounding a second alert. That wasn't part of the plan. Tekla must have gathered her legs against something down in the caboose, capable of pushing back, because all of a sudden she was flying toward them like a rocket. Her arms were in motion, reaching this way and that to slap at anything that could help her correct her course. But her eyes were fixed on Julia, and she was coming straight for her. Something gleamed in her hand, a thin arc of silver light, the honed edge of a dagger. A crisp, metallic noise resounded through the module as Julia pulled back the hammer on Pete Starling's revolver.
"Gun!"
shouted the bleeding man.
"Gun! Gun!"
If Tekla heard, she did not care, but only pushed back harder against a strut in the neighboring module and came on faster. To Julia, the weapon's recoil came too soon, as if it had gone off accidentally. She'd been in space long enough to know that it would knock her back, and it did. But she also saw things she could not explain, Camilla had entered the picture, flying in from the side with an arm outstretched.
The wall of the shipyard itself reached out to body check Tekla. A moment later it struck Camilla, then Julia. She had expected the high-pitched hiss of a bullet-sized hull puncture, but what followed was more like a roar, like the crowd in a football stadium when a pass is intercepted.
Camilla's arm had turned into a wing of fire.
Something took Julia from behind and hurled her toward the caboose. She looked around, thinking crazily that the bleeding man had somehow gotten loose and tackled her. But the force pushing her along was no human being. It was a torrent of escaping air.
"Jiro, can you hear me?"
Dinah asked for the fourth time. She conjectured that he could, but that he was simply too weak to answer. So she went ahead and delivered the good news.
"We made it," she said. "I have Izzy on optical. We'll converge with them in about half an hour."
"Good," he said.
"Good."
She was startled to hear anything at all, but the second good was a lot fainter than the first one, and she reckoned it was all he could get out. She decided not to tell him anything further. Entombed in Ymir's boiler room, simultaneously freezing to death while being cooked alive by radiation, he didn't need to hear a description of what Dinah was seeing through the telescope. They had been calling this the Cloud Ark for 2 years. The name had meant something poetically. Today, however, it really did look like a cloud. Her view of Izzy, which usually was so crisp and sharp in the high-contrast light of outer space, was cloaked in a glinting and winking shroud of what might be clinically described as particulate matter. It went without saying that Izzy had taken a direct hit from a bolide. Beyond that, it was difficult to make out details. Ymir's final burn, for Jiro, a suicide mission, had settled her in an orbit quite similar to Izzy's. The same plane, the same average altitude. The only difference was that it was a little bit more oval, calculated to cross Izzy's path twice during each revolution around the Earth. They were approaching one of those crossings, and so from Dinah's point of view, the space station kept getting closer, filling the window on her computer screen, obliging her to zoom out, giving her a progressively sharper, more detailed picture. As minutes ticked by, she was able to piece together a guess as to what had happened. The rock must have come in from an angle, missed Amalthea cleanly, and struck somewhere near H2, the hub that anchored Tauri 2 and 3. Both of the Tauri had huge bites taken out of them, and both had stopped rotating. Aft of that point, Izzy's spine, her central stack, was actually bent. The spreading wings of the shipyard were still attached to the caboose, but they were askew and leaking debris. The original torus, the one that contained the banana, was still rotating and looked whole, but as she drew closer, she saw it had taken damage, perhaps from shrapnel. A faint thud resounded through the ice hull. They'd probably struck a piece of jetsam. No matter. It wouldn't be moving very fast. Ymir could nuzzle her way through a cloud of that stuff and never feel it. One of the windows on her screen flashed up a video feed, triggered by the motion detector on a grab's camera, and she saw a human body drifting away into space. She swallowed against a sharp contraction of her throat. Part of her wondered if she would find Izzy a ghost ship, if she were the only human remaining alive. For Vyacheslav had stopped communicating with them yesterday. Before then, he had mentioned that he had been suffering from diarrhea. If this was caused by radiation exposure, it was a death sentence. He might simply have committed suicide rather than wait for the inevitable. Alone at the controls of Ymir, she coasted toward Izzy, silent and adrift in the cosmos, and entertained the thought, just for a while, that she might be the only human being left in the universe. Then a red light, a laser aimed right at her, began to flash from the mining colony,
and her mind began to pick out Morse code. Sending flivvers to effect final maneuvers. Disregard stray arclets. Welcome home. Lacking any way to respond, she waited and watched. Shreds of insulation, scraps of structural material, spilled vitamins, and the occasional body tumbled across the window as she panned and zoomed over various details. Everything forward of Zvezda looked pretty good. The mining colony and Moira's stash of genetic equipment appeared to be unscathed. Good. Three flivvers had separated themselves from the cloud and established trajectories that would bring them to Ymir within a few minutes. She guessed that they would act as tugboats. Butting their heads against the shard and using their main engines to effect the final Delta V needed to achieve rendezvous. So the first part of the transmission made sense. Disregard stray arclets, however, was something of a mystery. Why would there be such a thing? What did it mean, anyway, for an arclet to be stray? And yet, as Dinah panned the telescope across the arc of space forward and aft of Izzy, the realm where most of the arclets normally parked themselves, she found it curiously underpopulated. It was just a general visual impression. She couldn't verify it scientifically without access to a perambulator screen. It occurred to her then that all she needed to do was switch on her tablet's connection to the mesh network. Shortly after New Caird's departure from Izzy, she had turned it off because, once they got out of range, it was a useless battery drainer. And indeed, the tablet soon brought up the little icon announcing it had found a connection, perhaps relayed through one of those flivvers. A minute or two went by as the device downloaded all the email and message traffic that had been piling up in her inbox during her vacation. She passed the time playing with the telescope. A detail caught her eye as she panned across the scene, and she went back and zoomed in on it for a closer look. It was a MIV, an unusually big one. Basically a five-layer stack, wasp-waisted. The bottom layer was an engine of the most powerful class in the MIV toolkit. Above that was a fat cluster of propellant tanks. The third layer, the narrow waist, was a single arclet with an airlock on its side. A command module, she guessed, similar to New Caird's. Above that was a triad, and on top, forming the fat head of the vehicle, was a heptad. All of it was shrouded in structural webbing. Snared like little bugs in the edges of that web were small modules that she recognized as attitude control thrusters. The most notable thing about the vehicle was her outsized propellant tanks, hinting at a long journey. To where? The thing was keeping station several kilometers forward of Izzy in a region that had been largely denuded of arclets. Her tablet finally finished downloading messages, most of which were long out of date by this point. She sorted them by age, newest first, and scanned the headings. Very few had come through in the last several hours. That stood to reason, given that the Cloud Ark had other things on its mind. But close to the top was one that caught her eye. Open communique from President JBF to the people of the Cloud Ark. Merely seeing those words gave her a feeling as if she'd been socked in the solar plexus. She tapped it anyway and read it. "Today's shocking tragedy has left us all bereaved and seeking answers. I was in a shipyard module when it happened, having just bid farewell and godspeed to the brave explorers of the Red Hope expedition. Thanks to the automatic closure of a hatch, I experienced only minor injuries and discomfort from partial decompression. As we all know, many members of the general population were not so lucky. I join with all humanity in mourning their sacrifice. By its nature, the Archy community was less affected by this disaster. As I had envisioned from the very beginnings of the Cloud Ark project, the distributed architecture of the swarm prevented serious damage. We did lose three arclets, I am sorry to say, and several more sustained damage from minor collisions or debris impacts.
But overall, the system worked as we had planned from the beginning. Many members of the AC are now, quite naturally, asking themselves whether it is safe to remain in low Earth orbit, clustered around a heavy, aging space station that lacks the ability to maneuver out of harm's way. The open vista of clean space beckons above us. Red Hope will soon fire its main engine and begin its trek across that unexplored frontier to a planet that will one day have room for us all. The Cloud Ark cannot follow her, yet. But as all members of the AC know, having gone through extensive training in space operations and orbital mechanics, it is well within the capability of any Arklet to raise its orbit substantially by making use of its engines and its onboard propellant supplies. Alone, a single Arklet, Triad, or Heptad will not long endure. As part of a swarm, however, it has a fighting chance. Many members of the Arki community who have been watching the desperate trials and tribulations of the Ymir expedition and who have now witnessed the damage inflicted upon Izzy by a single bolide are now asking themselves whether it is safe to remain and to trust themselves to the agonizingly slow climb toward clean space envisioned by the partisans of the Big Ride faction. I am a politician, not a scientist. And so I cannot pretend to render a technical opinion. Some may question whether I should be making a public announcement at all. The simple fact of the matter is that my past career as President of the United States has given me prominence in the Arki community, whether or not I deserve it. Many have been asking me what I shall do now. Rather than wait for rumor to sow confusion, I am therefore issuing this communique. For what it is worth, I have, with the assistance of some loyal friends, escaped from the wreckage of Izzy and found safe haven aboard Arklet 37, currently part of a triad. Shortly after I transmit this message, we will initiate a burn of our main propulsion that will lift us clear of the drifting debris that surrounds what was once the International Space Station and move us in the direction of clean space. Our orbital parameters will be posted openly on the network so that like-minded members of the AC may join us in creating a swarm-based solution to the acute problems currently imposing themselves on the human race. From a safe position in higher orbit, we will look for ways to extend a helping hand to our surviving friends marooned in the general population. Working together as a community, we will preserve what we have and build a stable way of life in the sky as we await with breathless anticipation the results of Red Hope's inspiring venture to the welcoming surface of Mars.
She's right about the breathless part of it, Dinah muttered to herself, closing the window and looking at the timestamp again. It had been transmitted 3 hours ago. Then, only half an hour ago, Ivy had responded with a counter-communique. Dinah didn't read it, but based on the subject heading, she knew what it would say. Don't listen to JBF. Stay in formation. We need you, and you need us. But from what Dinah was seeing, both through the optical telescope and on perambulator, Ivy's message had come too late to forestall the departure of a large number of Arklets. Somewhere out there, up above them in higher orbit, a new swarm was taking shape, running its own independent instance of perambulator and looking to JBF for leadership. Dinah had been through many emotional ups and downs while retrieving Ymir. More downs than ups, of course, given the fatality rate. In a strange way, however, the emotional high point was just a few moments ago when she had scanned the word desperate in JBF's communique. She rather liked being described as desperate, particularly when she was just on the verge of succeeding. Perambulator was working on her screen now. She used it to check the status of those three flivvers. They were still closing. Messages were starting to come in from their pilots, trying to make out whether anyone was still alive in the shard, whether it was safe to approach. Dinah texted back. One survivor. Stand clear for a sec while this thing takes a big glow-in-the-dark crap.
Then she pulled up the window she used to communicate with her network of robots and typed in a single-word command. Jettison. It was the name of a program that Sean had started, Lars had improved, and Dinah had recently finished. It was a program meant to be run simultaneously by every robot in the Shard, as well as some other systems down in the boiler room. A prompt came back. Are you sure? Y/in. Why? She typed. Congratulations! Came back. The dead crew of Ymir had sent her a message from the void. She pushed herself over to the companionway, got her head aimed down through the hole in the floor, and pulled herself straight to the bottom level of the command module. The hatch in the floor, the one that led to the ice tunnel that terminated in the boiler room, had already been closed, as a basic safety measure. But Dinah verified that one last time and made sure it was sealed, because in a few seconds there would be nothing but vacuum on the other side of it. Ymir had begun grumbling. Dinah felt as if she were trapped inside the belly of a frost giant with indigestion. What she was hearing, she knew, was the collective noise made by thousands of gnats and hundreds of larger robots as they moved to safe positions on the inner surface of the hollow shard and gnawed away at the structural webbing that connected it to the reactor core. She returned to her seat in the command module and pulled up a video feed from the interior of the shard. Its walls were now thin enough to admit some sunlight, and so it had become a sort of vast, pellucid amphitheater where all of those robots could look inward to the smooth beryllium pod, a neutron-reflecting shroud surrounding the reactor core. Formerly, this had been buried in ice. The recent excavations made to fuel the big perigee burns had left it exposed, also revealing the smaller pod of the boiler room mounted on its side, and the system of hoppers and augers that fed it. Aft of that was what remained of the ice cavern of the nozzle bell, now mostly melted away to expose the blackness of space beyond. The only thing now holding the reactor chamber in place was the massive central thrust pillar, a tree trunk of ice that grew from its forward end and extended straight up to the solid nose of the shard, where the command module was embedded. Jettison did her the courtesy of showing a countdown on the screen so that she could plug her ears. When it hit zero, a sickening crack resounded through the whole structure. The video feed showed a brilliant spray of ice blown free from the central pillar just above where it connected to the reactor vessel. Demolition charges, placed there long ago by Sean's crew, had detonated and severed the connection. For a moment she feared nothing further would happen, but then jets of white steam lanced from the reactor vessel's rounded top. Jettison had opened valves, releasing pressure that had built up in the chamber from the reactor's residual heat, and those valves were now acting as makeshift rocket engines, pushing the whole reactor and everything attached to it down toward the vacancy of the nozzle. The entire reactor chamber dropped out the bottom of the shard and was gone. If Jettison continued to do its work, the reactor, now a free-floating vehicle, all brawn and no brains, would execute a few clumsy maneuvers to kill its own orbital velocity and drop itself into the atmosphere.
Bye, Jiro, Dinah said. Thank you.
One of the Flivver pilots texted her, Wow. Dinah gave it all one more thorough scan, using several cameras. But there wasn't much to see. Ymir was now a hollow, sugar-loaf-shaped shell, crawling with robots and helplessly adrift in space. She texted, Did someone place an order for a megaton of propellant? Instinct had herded them together in the scrum. Close to Amalthea, and far away from the parts of Izzy that had been damaged or destroyed. That was where Dinah found them, after she'd been brought aboard, scrubbed clean, checked and checked again for contamination. Pink and raw, she embraced Ivy first for a long time, and then made the rounds to Dube, Moira, Reese, Louisa, Steve Lake, Fyodor, and Beau. Conrad Barth and many others were dead. Tekla was still in surgery. One of her breasts had been damaged by a fragment and was being surgically repaired. Curled up, in very nearly a fetal position at one end of the scrum, was a woman who was quietly weeping. She hid her face from the room with an arm swathed, from fingertips to shoulder, in white gauze.
Dinah recognized her as Camilla, Julia's sidekick.
Ivy insisted that they all move back down the stack and meet in the banana.
It took some gentle persuasion to get Camilla to come with them,
but eventually Louisa talked her into it. Out of habit, she kept reaching for the veil she normally drew across the lower half of her face, but it wasn't there anymore. She was dressed like everyone else in a shapeless coverall.
"What is Camilla doing here?"
Dinah asked Moira as they maneuvered down the stack. Moira had obviously been crying and seemed badly shaken up. She and Tekla had become a couple at some point, and Moira was taking the news of her partner's injury hard. "Tekla came for JBF," Moira said, "and JBF tried to shoot her.
Camilla reached out and grabbed for the gun, I guess.
She was always wearing that gauzy wrap as a veil. The fabric caught fire from the flash of the gun and burned her arm before she could get it off. But she saved Tekla? Who knows? The bullet struck something else and fragmented, apparently." The holes where shrapnel had struck T1, the first, oldest, and smallest torus, had been patched, and it had been repressurized. They had always considered it a safe place before. They needed to begin thinking of it in that light again, which was why Ivy had insisted they come here. They took seats in the banana. The numbers had come in. Ivy opened the meeting by reciting them. At the onset of the hard rain, the human population, not counting any who might still be alive on Earth, had been 1,551, or 1,553, if you counted the two late arrivals, Julia and Pete Starling. Starling hadn't even made it out of his space capsule, so the initial number had been 1,552. At the same time, there had been 305 occupied free-flying arklets, plus 11 spares that were attached to Izzy but not occupied. The free-flying ones had housed 1,364 people. The remaining 188 humans had lived aboard Izzy as members of the general population. But at any given time, 10% of the Arkies had been rotating through Izzy, bringing its population on a typical day up to 324. Prior to today's disaster, 26 people had been killed in various mishaps, mostly smaller bolide strikes. Another 24 were now aboard the stolen MIV calling itself Red Hope, and if their claims were taken at face value, they would soon be en route to Mars. Of the persons who had been aboard Izzy at the time of the disaster, 211 had been killed outright, and another 24 or so remained in critical condition. The number of living people aboard Izzy had therefore been reduced to 113. The general population, the older, more experienced, highly trained specialists, had been reduced from 188 to 106. At the moment of the disaster, 1,178 persons had been living in arklets. The distributed nature of the swarm, combined with the fact that many arklets had flown the coop with Julia, made it difficult to estimate casualties. The best estimate they currently had was that 17 arklets had fallen victim, with assumed 100% loss of life, reducing that population to about 1,100. If that was correct, then the day's full death toll had been close to 300. In terms of arklet count, they'd started the day with 299 surviving, occupied arklets, a figure that had been reduced to 282 by the collision. 10 of them, a heptad and a triad, were attached to Red Hope, leaving 272. Approximately 200 were missing and presumed to have flown the coop with JBF. The remaining 70 or so had elected to stay behind and were still reporting in as members in good standing of the Cloud Ark. The 11 spares were still attached to Izzy and would be inspected for damage later. The Arklets still with them probably had a population of some 300. That, plus the survivors aboard Izzy, added up to a bit over 400. The population of JBF's breakaway swarm must then be something like 800 souls. She had taken 2/3 of the human race with her.
God forgive me, Dube said, but right now I don't even care about headcount. The number I'm after is engines. Arklet engines. Until Dinah showed up with all of that ice, they were useless. Now we have a way to fuel them. If we get them all pointed in the same direction, all pushing on Izzy, we can go on the big ride.
He paused to look at his notes. With his reading glasses down on his nose, he suddenly looked a lot older to Dinah. She could only imagine how she looked.
Based on what you just told me, am I right in thinking we have...
About 70, Ivy said, plus the 11 spares. We haven't checked those yet, but on visual inspection they seem undamaged.
81,
Dube said.
I like that number. A perfect square.
A perfect square of perfect squares, Rhys put in.
If we could come up with a structural system for ganging them in clusters of 9, just a 3x3 grid, with shared propellant feeds, and make 9 of those clusters, and integrate them into Izzy's structure somehow, that being the hard part, then we'd have an array of 81 engines. If those things all come on at full power when we pass through perigee, it'll give us enough combined thrust to make a difference. I think we can make the big ride work with that level of power.
It's a lot of structure, Fyodor pointed out. A lot, a lot, a lot.
We have a lot of raw materials to work with, don't we? Louisa asked. I've seen rolls and rolls of that aluminum ribbon for feeding into the extruder machines.
It is a question of time, Fyodor said. Yes, we have a lot of material, but to assemble it with so few people is difficult. Atmosphere is growing. Drag is increasing. Orbit is decaying.
Dinah looked across the table at Rhys. Rhys, the biomimetic engineer, the man who had perhaps saved Ymir with his idea of turning robots into little radiation-resistant Ben Grimms. We'll build it out of ice, Dinah said. Rhys looked up at her, pondered it for a second, and nodded.
Too brittle, Fyodor said.
I don't think Dinah's speaking of regular ice, Rhys said. She means the pycrete stuff they used on Ymir. Fiber-reinforced ice. It worked to hold the shard together. We can make it work here.
Moira spoke up.
Perhaps I'm missing something, but I was under the impression that the ice was our propellant. Aren't we going to melt it and consume it as we go along?
Yes,
Dube said.
And doesn't that mean that we'll be consuming the structure that's holding everything together?
Yes, Dube repeated, but it's okay. Because the more of it we use, the lighter we get, and the less thrust we need. So it's okay to sacrifice some structure as we go along.
Sal had been listening intently.
I don't mean to throw cold water on the idea,
he said. The pun, assuming he meant it as such, elicited a few groans.
But we've been hearing about radioactive contamination.
On the outer surface of the shard, yes, Dinah said. Microscopic motes of stuff that is super radioactive. Stuck to the ice. Beta won't penetrate our living spaces. We'll have to be careful, though, not to track it inside. We can program robots to crawl around, look for those hot motes, and get rid of them over time.
Sal looked unconvinced. I won't lie to you, Dinah said. People are going to die of it.
But the trade is as follows, Rhys said. Izzy already has a massive battering ram of nickel iron on her snout. Her flanks are vulnerable, as we learned today. Now we have the ability to shroud everything, the entire space station, in reinforced ice. Oh, it will dwindle over time. But through most of the big ride, we'll be living deep inside of a gigantic iceberg with a steel nose. I submit that the death toll from possible contamination will be minor compared to what we would experience if we went on the same journey unprotected.
What do you need to make it happen? Ivy asked.
Permission, Dinah said.
When did you ever ask for that before?
The joke elicited a high-pitched laugh from the corner of the conference room.
Heads turned toward Camilla. Camilla,
Ivy said. We've hardly heard a word from you since we found you in the shipyard. One of our witnesses there claims you may have saved Tekla's life. You had the opportunity to escape with Julia. Instead, you stayed behind to free the bound shipyard workers. You saved their lives. Now you're here among us. You must know how this looks.
The look on Camilla's face made it clear that how it looked
had never crossed her mind. She didn't even get what Ivy was saying.
Dear, Louisa said, people are going to say you are a spy who volunteered to be left behind.
Camilla held up a closed fist
and opened it to reveal a small white plastic box, loose tape still dangling from it.
Julia's bug, she announced. It was here.
No one looked very convinced.
She invited me to dinner at the White House,
Camilla said.
She helped me pick out a dress. She introduced me to generals, ambassadors, movie stars. She wrote me letters on White House stationery. I was in love with her. You can call me naive if you want. All right. I was naive. Until this morning. And then, all of a sudden, I saw. I saw what I was dealing with. I hate her now. And I hate myself for having been in love with her.
Best remember that, sweetheart, Moira said, because she made the wrong choice today, and sooner or later, she'll be coming back.
I'll be ready,
Camilla said.